You're listening to Making Contact.
On this edition of Making Contact, we'll explore the unique cultural and historical specificity of corporal punishment in Black homes and its connections to racial violence in America. We'll speak with author Dr. Stacy Patton about her latest book, Spare the Kids, Why Whipping Won't Save Black America. Dr. Patton, first, thank you so much for joining us today here on the program. The idea of whipping or spanking in America has been largely accepted under the adage, spare the rod, spoil the child. This particular adage for years has justified the physical discipline of children. Talk a bit about the larger societal interpretation of spare the rod, spoil the child, and how this interpretation has duped Black parents in participating in the dehumanization process of Black children, as well as interfered in our abilities to parent.
So firstly, spare the rod, spoil the child is one of those popular phrases that gets invoked in debates over hitting children. And even people who don't go to church, that's the one scripture they love to misquote. And it's actually not even in the Bible. Spare the rod, spoil the child is a line that comes from a 16th century poem called Hudibras. The closest thing you'll see to that in the Bible is Proverbs 13:24. He that spareth the rod hateth his son. But here's the thing, that when you read the Bible, you have to understand Hebrew, the original interpretation of scripture. You also have to understand historical context as well. And so what happens is we often have this very literal interpretation of scripture. A rod is a symbol. It connotes wisdom and direction. In terms of it being an actual thing, it's like it has long and has a staff on it and like a crook at the top of it. And it's used for guiding sheep. So if a sheep, you know, got away from the rest of the flock and got stuck in a hilly area or something like that, the shepherd would take it and pull the sheep back in so that they're protected. The only time a shepherd would wield a rod is to ward off wolves. Sheep were very valuable. They were used for sacrifices to God. And so you didn't want to give God a sacrifice that was blemished in any sort of way. So you don't see where shepherds are picking up a rod and hitting a child. There are a number of verses in Proverbs that talk about the rod being used on the backs of adults. But we see people conspicuously quiet about those verses as well. One of the things I talk about a lot, too, is how Christianity is not native to our West African ancestors who ended up on those ships and were dropped off in different parts of the diaspora. We weren't reading Bibles. We didn't worship Jesus. And that's not to say that Christianity didn't exist in Africa prior to Europeans' contacts with folks from West Africa. It existed in Egypt and Ethiopia, but West Africans didn't learn Christianity from them. And so we didn't believe this concept of born in sin. We weren't saying spare the rod, spoil the child. It wasn't part of a parenting blueprint that we brought over here. And for the first 100 years of enslavement in this country, West Africans did not, well, enslaved Africans here did not practice Christianity in any significant numbers. They weren't even speaking English. It was illegal for them to read and to write. Ultimately, the kind of Christianity that they would be indoctrinated into is slave Christianity. There was a piece that just came out on NPR talking about a slave Bible from the 19th century that was used to indoctrinate slaves into Christianity. There's all kinds of passages that are missing from that. So we really need to understand Hebrew. We need to understand how we came to this religion, under what circumstances. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to practice Christianity, we need to purge out some of the toxic theology that is hurting our children and hurting our communities. Mm-hmm.
to reiterate what was just said, the correlation is that white supremacy, religion, historically has been used as a tool to oppress and control. And this has tricked some black folks on the ways in which one may discipline a child. Based on your thoughts, how do these ideas of physical punishment aid in destroying black humanity? And how does it intersect with racism and black parenting?
Well, see, a lot of black parents will tell me that whooping children is a black thing, that white people don't beat their kids. And I said, that's absolutely false. Whooping your child is the whitest thing you can do to destroy a black child. When you understand the historical trajectory of corporal punishment as a ritualistic disciplinary practice, it emerged in Europe. There are societies around the world, indigenous cultures in North America, South America, in Africa, where this type of coercion and physical, ritualistic physical punishment of children did not exist because children were held in a completely different value. You know, West Africans, for example, didn't believe that children were born in sin. They believed they were reincarnated ancestors. The Nigerians gave their kids names like Babatunde, father has returned, Yetatunde, mother has returned. The Bang people would never put a child, a baby on the floor because it was disrespectful to do this to a god. And so the process of colonialism, the Middle Passage experience, the enslavement process, indoctrination into Western Christianity altered the way people on this side of the diaspora, you know, parented their kids. And it also altered what would happen in the aftermath of colonialism on the other side of the diaspora. So we have to understand beating kids as a historical process that is connected to white supremacist ideology about children, about race, about black bodies, and how it functioned in turning human bodies into chattel for profit, and how it created a kind of elusive black parenting where black parents were given this idea that they could control their children's destiny, mitigate harms, be protective by preparing them for the harsh realities of plantation life. I mean, we still see this today when parents say, well, you know, better for me to beat my child than the police officer to assault them, arrest them, or kill them. And I say, well, how's that working for Black America?
I call it the beloved complex.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's very real. And I want to get into that. But also, one thing in preparing for this conversation, in the past, you've said that your activist work is centered on saving black children from brutality and death at the hands of people that love them. I want to really talk more about that statement and then also how did you get into this work and why are you so passionate?
So I often hear black parents say, once again, better for me to beat my child than for the police to kill them. And then I'll ask, well, you know, name the black children who have been killed by police officers, the unarmed black children. They can tell me about Tamir Rice. They can tell me about Mike Brown and a few others. And then I'll say, well, how many black children are killed each year in this country at the hands of their parents and caretakers as a result of child abuse? And they'll guess maybe a dozen. And I'll say, no, it's about 360 black children who are killed every year in this country. That's a fatality rate that's three times higher than all other racial groups. And most of the perpetrators are black women age 40 and under. This is what the data tells us. And so I have to give them a very harsh truth that black children are actually more at risk of being assaulted, seriously injured, or killed by their parents and caretaker than a police officer. Now, I understand the fear that a lot of folks parent with. And it is real. State-sanctioned violence against black bodies, regardless of age, is real. It's always been real. Black parents, going all the way back to slavery and in the post-Reconstruction era, during the lynching eras, always had this fear of how can they keep their children alive? How can they, what can they do to make sure they survive childhood and come out okay? And as a people, you know, we need to understand that our children can grow up to be healthy, productive, loving, law-abiding citizens without us putting our hands on them. And we often speak the grammar of white supremacy when we talk about our kids. These kids today, blah, blah, blah. these kids need a whooping. And, you know, and then when we grow up, we celebrate it. We say, well, I'm the man I am today. I'm the woman I am today because my mama whooped me. I'm not in jail. I'm not, you know, I don't, you know, steal things. I'm not on drugs and all of this sort of thing. So we have some people have very low standards about their prospects. And I say to them, well, then you agree with Massa that in order to make black people into good people, that we have to process our bodies through violence. So beating children is a form of internalized racism, and it is so rife in our culture.
Spanking doesn't necessarily mean that, or disciplining your child physically doesn't mean that you will protect them from the world. I mean, there was an article that you wrote about a young man who, I think uncle or father had beat him on social media. And it was because he was participating in street tribes or gang culture, right? The young man wound up being killed anyway. So it's not like it's a guarantee. And you mentioned something that was really shocking to me. It was like, you said 360 black children per year. That's almost a death per day. What would you attribute to these high numbers, and why is this plaguing and happening within our community so much?
So it's a combination of things. It's poverty. It's neglect. It's frustration. It's not having enough resources. It's living in around eco hazards and food deserts. It's a number of stressors. And then people who are parenting with their own untreated traumas as well. It's not having alternatives. You know, there's all kinds of triggers for this. And, you know, his parents not having resources and not being given parenting classes and things like that. And also that we live in a culture that celebrates violence against children. I mean, parents are the only group. When you think about family violence or domestic violence, parents are the only group of hitters where it is okay for them to publicly celebrate hitting kids and to repeat it. And so we have comedy. We have comedians who joke about it. Everybody's talking about Kevin Hart now, but he's joked about, you know, hitting his son over the head with a dollhouse if he caught his child playing with his daughter's toys. He joked about punching his 9-year-old daughter in the throat for wanting juice. Bernie Mac did it. The Wayans brothers. I mean, you know, many of our most noted black comedians have joked about it. Preachers preach about it. People write songs celebrating black mothers who beat their kids. So everywhere we turn, there are people who are adding to this ecosystem of childism and aggression toward kids. On social media, people are picking up video cameras and recording themselves, shaming and beating their kids for validation, for likes. You see this on sites like World Star Hip Hop, on Facebook Live, YouTube. It's a whole genre of it. So we've got this entire ecosystem that contributes to the degradation of children and ultimately and sadly, in some cases, their deaths.
Mm-hmm. One more popular image that to reiterate what you just said would be Toya Graham. This is in Baltimore. This is post Freddie Gray rebellions. Her son is an African-American woman who was, you know, hitting her son upside his head because he was with a group of young men who were throwing rocks at the police officers. People held her as being the mother of the year, and this is how we're supposed to treat our kids, and this is tough love. Is this tough love? And if not, what should she have done? How should she have responded to her fear and concern around her son being another Freddie Gray?
So the whole conversation about tough love is problematic for me because a lot of people see the hitting as love. Those two things don't belong in the same sentence at all.
So love is not pain.
Love is not pain. It okay. Should not hurt. And just from a developmental perspective, it, you know, children's brains begin growing at infancy. It's not complete. You don't come out the womb with a complete brain. So all this developmental stuff keeps happening over the lifespan of the child. Brain development completes at age 24. So when you're hitting kids, what happens as they're developing is the messages of pain and love merge together in the prefrontal cortex of the brain. And so the two become a biological experience. So people develop these dysfunctional messages about love. And we wonder why boys may grow up to become men who hit women, why women stay in relationships where they are subjected to being hit because their parents primed them for this. So that whole conversation about tough love was so problematic. I wrote a piece in the Washington Post about Toya Graham, and I took a lot of heat from black folks and white folks who said she was a hero. And I said she was not a hero. Like you, I understood her fear, her anxiety. She said, I didn't want my son to become another Freddie Gray. I totally get that. What bothered me was the larger conversation and celebration of a black mother going upside, you know, a young black male's head in public and everyone seizing this as a moment to celebrate. So the message was, we don't need the police. We don't need the National Guard. Send out the black moms to beat these boys. So then the message also is that these young thugs are the true enemy of peace. It's not about generational divestment in Baltimore City. It's not about the broken schools. It's not about the echo hazards. It's not about lead poisoning in neighborhoods like where Freddie Gray grew up. It's not about, you know, not having culturally relevant pedagogy in the schools. It's not about any of this systemic and intentional divestment of black life in Baltimore. So rather than confront those issues, whoop your children. That's a problem I had with that entire conversation. So, you know, police brutality gets let off the hook. Militarized policing gets let off the hook. All of these things, we just have to whoop our kids some more.
Right. And I definitely understand the mother's fear. But maybe for the listening audience of Making Contact, Dr. Patton, you can briefly explain the black experience in regards to that fear that I'm labeling the beloved complex, the protective behavioral strategy employed by a lot of black parents in the rearing of their children. And how does this particular strategy hinder a black child's development?
In many ways, I'll take on the personal development issue. We know more about science and how the brain works and how the body works. We know about the connection. We know about things like epigenetics and how toxic stress can become biologically embedded in our bodies.
And DNA.
And literally change the DNA. And then you can pass on trauma to subsequent generations. So we know that slavery, the traumas of Jim Crow and segregation and so forth have had a profound effect on us. Black people have only been parenting legally their children for about 150 years. So since the end of slavery. And then if you add in Jim Crow, that's about 50 years. So it's a very small window. And then we've faced mass incarceration, you know, war on drugs, state sanctioned violence, all of these different things that have kept our communities under siege. And after slavery, it wasn't like they let us go and then there were all these shrinks standing on the edges of plantations saying, come, let's do some healing work now. Let's have some aromatherapy and yoga. Let's talk about that rape. Let's talk about the breakup of your families. There was none of that. It's not like we had, you know, a long period where we could adjust and bring our families together and so forth. We continue to be under siege, right? So we're still young parents for the most part. We still have the audacity to have children while navigating the insanity of white supremacy. So I understand generational trauma and how it has affected our understanding of ourselves, the value of our children, how we speak about our children. But I honestly think, and I think about this a lot, that if we had left whipping children on the plantation where it was and had not continued this practice for the first 150 years out of slavery, where would we be? Mm. Right. You know, that first trauma is continuing to be compounded and passed on from one generation to the next. And I wonder if that kind of coercive, violent parenting has stunted our ability to be more radical, to be more activists, right? Because with the beatings, you're separating, you're trying to break somebody. You're trying to quell a rebellious spirit. And, you know, you're trying to put somebody in place. You're trying to keep them in control, keep them in line. And so I wonder if we had just left the master's lash where it was, if we could be people who would have become much more radical and not accepting more abuse and victimization, along with the forgiveness narrative. That's a whole other discussion as well. But I do wonder about this, because quite frankly, white people really don't have to do anything else to us. We're kind of on autopilot with this. And now, for myself as an academic and a child advocate, I find that one of the most controversial things for me to take on is to tell Black people to love themselves and their children, to treat their children like gods. Like, that's really controversial, to say respect your child's bodily integrity, right? To tell people that, you know, our kids deserve better. Don't shame them, right? And it's a controversial thing.
Moving forward in our conversation and looking more at corporal punishment within schools, the national conversation has really overlooked the horrendous truths when it comes to the physical discipline within schools. I personally was surprised to learn that corporal punishment is legal in 18 states. That's over 160,000 students in these states that are subjected to corporal punishment in one school year. And in 2012, for instance, Black children made up 18% of the student population, but were 35% of the reported cases involving corporal punishment, according to the Education Department Office for Civil Rights. Dr. Patton, if Black children make up only 18% of the student population, but are 35% of the reported cases involving corporal punishment, why is it that our children are being disproportionately punished in this manner?
So it's 18 states that allow corporal punishment in public schools, and most of those, pretty much all of them, are confined to the South. When you look at a map of where this is still legal, those states also mirror the southern states that had the largest number of lynchings. It corresponds. And corporal punishment is legal in every state, with the exception of New Jersey and Iowa, allows corporal punishment in charter and private schools. We don't have the federal data because those schools don't get federal funding and don't have to report. So we don't even know how widespread the problem is in those types of schools. So you have situations where parents will sign opt-in forms. So to say, if my kid is acting out, go ahead and paddle them so I don't have to come from work to do this. We do see a slow downticking in instances where kids are being hit, but Black children and children with developmental disabilities are disproportionately the ones that are punished. That's because you have a national school system that is predominantly white and female in terms of the teaching force. And so they have, they come into the class and they process children through an attributional lens that is colored by racial biases. Black children's behavior, even when they act out the same way as white kids, it's just perceived differently. White children who are paddled get paddled for things like destroying school property, bringing weapons, you know, things like that. But Black children are punished for behaviors like not having the right clothes on, you know, challenging a teacher, rolling their eyes, you know, just disrespect in that sort of way. And so we see Black adolescents and adolescents in general in the society being criminalized. A century ago or even a half a century ago, you know, things that teachers and principals would deal with in the school through detentions or talking to a kid, now they've bought in, you know, police officers and school resource officers to do this. So that's contributing to it. It just boggles my mind how the law says that teachers and principals are supposed to be mandated reporters for child abuse, yet you put paddles in those same people's hands. And Black people buy into this type of Jim Crow education. And so they actually think it's good. And the thing is, we have to be clear that this isn't necessarily always cross-racial physical punishment that's going on. In my book, I talk about this issue in Mississippi. The schools are, you know, heavily segregated. So it's Black principals and black teachers beating black children. And it's sanctioned by the community. And generally, paddling is the first step in the school-to-prison pipeline. So instead of dealing with overcrowded schools, you know, bad resources, horrible educational outcomes, poverty, you know, all of those things, just paddle the kids in school.
Explain that further, how this is directly related to the school-to-prison pipeline.
Mm-hmm. So it goes hand in hand with, you know, the disproportionate suspensions and expulsions of black children for the same sorts of behaviors. Just the this part is just physical. When you have national policies like No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, where there's this pressure to produce good outcomes through a testing culture with pedagogy that's not culturally relevant to students. It's not teaching them critical thinking skills. It's not tapping into their talents. It's not inspiring kids. You have a revolving door of teachers who are outside of the student's culture. You have overcrowded classrooms. It's a powder keg. It produces, educational environments that, you know, are not stimulating, are coercive. So when you have kids who are being hit in the classroom or in the principal's office, it changes the energy. Just like, you know, metal detectors. You know, imagine coming to school every day and you've got to go through a metal detector. That doesn't make you feel good about, you know, going to school every day. And people will point to Columbine as the beginning of this. When you had middle-class white boys who went and shot up a school, but black schools bore the brunt of all of this militarization within the school system. That's why I have to laugh when I hear black people say, well, our kids don't shoot up schools. Well, that's because they got metal detectors in there because the racists decided that, oh, these white boys shot up the school, but we're going to put the metal detectors in the black schools. You know, and it's just such a dysfunctional conversation. Imagine having a kid who's hit in the classroom and then that impacts, you know, how they feel, there's shame involved. It messes with the learning environment itself. A kid who might hit a teacher back who tries to hit them will be charged with a felony for trying to practice self-defense in those situations. You have male teachers who paddle female students. You have teachers and principals and coaches who've actually injured kids, but many of these districts have something called an immunity clause, which basically says if you injure a child while, you know, in the course of administrating this, you will not be prosecuted. But yet a parent who bruises their child and they end up in an emergency room will be prosecuted for this. So it falls right in the it's just another tactic to push kids out of schools and into the juvenile justice system.
For a parent who's listening to this conversation and they're processing, and they've maybe been guilty of this as well, what kind of tools can you offer them in this moment so that they don't opt to do that? One story in particular that I recall, and it wasn't like I can say that my mom gave me a lot of spankings, right? But when I think about the correlation or how racism intersects with, you know, spanking of children and beating children and white supremacy, I remember my mother telling me one time, go in your room, take off all your clothes. Now, is that not slavery? It's like a slave movie, right? You know,
well, you see it in the archives. I mean, most of my beatings happen with me taking my clothes off. And, you know, when you go back and you look at the, you know, WPA narratives and such, you know, they would remove clothes from slaves because, you know, clothing was very expensive. But it was also a way to degrade and sexualize. You know, imagine being a child, if you're a little girl, and your father is being stripped naked in front of you and whipped by someone, or vice versa. You're watching your daughter do this. You know, one particular one that got me was my adoptive mother's father, who was a Pentecostal minister, used to do sermons where he would mimic how he used to beat his kids. He said, you know, I used to lock their head between my legs so they couldn't escape. My adoptive mother did that to me. And then I was floored many years later in grad school when I saw this same exact technique being meted out onto slaves. And I said, this practice continues. This dehumanization process continues.
Once you know better, you do better. So what kind of tools can you offer parents? Understanding that history and that trauma that's associated with slavery and where we're at today and how this has bled into our personal lives, especially in how we rear and raise our children to enter into the world, right? What kind of tools can you provide them with initially so that they will begin to move down a different path that's non-physical when we think about punishment?
Mm-hmm. So I think step one is to do some self-reflection. Look back on your own childhood. Connect with your child body. And remember how you really felt when someone was threatening you, putting their hands on you. Remember what that belt felt like. Remember what that set of switches felt like. And be honest and own those feelings. Remember the triggers. So a lot of times people will hit their kid for normal developmental behaviors, particularly if they grew up in a house that was very strict, where, you know, if you did something wrong, that was completely normal, by the way, and your parent hit you. And so now you're a parent and your kid is doing the same thing. A lot of times you're actually reacting, their behavior triggers you because you're actually reacting to stuff that happened in your own childhood. So step one is dealing with your own childhood, being honest about how you felt, dealing with those feelings, putting language to those experiences, putting feelings to those experiences, and experiencing whatever comes from that. Trying to have a conversation with your parents, even though it might be hard. Learning about child development, right? What's normal behavior? Learn about the, you know, brain development, what's normal for a toddler to do, an infant, and so on and so forth. So what's happening with your child's body? Learn about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, the side effects of hitting kids, right? All of that is really found in the cultural conversation, you know, learning that a lot of the stuff that we've been taught, it's all a myth, right? Your mama lied, your grandma lied. The preacher lied, right? And I'm not saying this in a disrespectful sort of way because they've just been parodying, you know, these lessons.
And you also said this is a loss of control by the parent when they act in this manner.
Yes. So a lot of parents get angry with me when I say hitting your child is harmful and you should stop. Well, if you're a people who, you know, for generations have been under siege, it is very easy to misconstrue cruelty for love and protection. And so, you know, they really think that they're preventing their child from entering the prison system. And I say, go watch The 13th, right? That documentary will take you all the way back to the post-Reconstruction era and talk about the rise of the carceral state. And once again, in the 1970s with the war on drugs, and you see all the players. You know, mass incarceration doesn't exist because we're not beating children enough. It's because of greed and racism. And this is what white supremacy does, right? So learn that history. Understand systemic racism. Understand how it manifests itself in the school systems and so on and so forth. So we need to, again, this is changing the cultural conversation. And then learning alternatives to hitting your kid. You know, doing the hard work. You know, learning about positive discipline, nurturing parenting, you know, how do you teach your child not to touch the hot stove without hitting them? The goal is to get them to fear the hot stove, not you. You know, things like bedwetting, a toddler biting you, you don't bite the kid back. You know, their language systems are not developed. So how do we redirect that behavior? How do we do positive reinforcement? So they've got to do some work. We've got to read. And I know that's hard, particularly with parents who, you know, might not have other resources, might be living in impoverished neighborhoods, working multiple jobs. All of this, the violence of poverty makes it difficult for us to be open to learning new strategies. So I'm sensitive to that. And I understand my privilege as someone who has the time, you know, to study these things, to sit around writing books about this kind of thing. But we've got to have it. And our pastors, the people we trust in our communities, they've got to change their language as well.
Right. And I do want to agree with you that, you know, it may be a lot for a parent, especially a single parent who's raising one or two children. But think about the amount of time that you may spend watching a TV program. So with today in our society, when you can Google something, mm-hmm. I mean, you can pretty much
anything.
Google Dr. Stacey Patton on a conversation about this, you know, very subject. So I think the tools are there, whether or not the will is.
Yes.
Again, I just want to let folks know that I've been speaking with Dr. Stacey Patton. We've been discussing her latest book, Spirit of the Kids, Why Whipping Won't Save Black America. If you've enjoyed this week's program, do us a favor by sharing this episode with folks or join us online at www.radioproject.org and drop us a comment about today's program. Also, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team consists of Lisa Redman, Salima Himarani, Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, Dylan Hoyer, and Sabine Blazin. I'm Anita Johnson. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.